Good evening, everybody. This is Chew the Fat with Craig Hartman. This is the podcast where all you people who love food, wine, and all things about it can go and find out exactly what it takes, exactly what it is behind the people who make your life so happy. And this is the place where you're not going to get any sugar coating. Pardon the pun. You're not going to get any publicists blocking us here. We're going to learn everything there is about the people that you love. Tonight, speaking of loving people, we have the world famous Tomas Rahal from Mas Tapas in Charlottesville, Virginia. Arguably the favorite restaurant in all of Charlottesville, and people who love Mas, they are worshipers of this restaurant. I tried to get him to worship me, but no go. It was all Tomas Rahal, and we have Tomas here tonight. He has a interesting background and an interesting perspective, and we're gonna learn what fuels Tomas and what is inside that head of his. So, hey man, what's going on tonight?
Good evening, Craig. Nice to be here.
Don't be so reserved, you know.
This is my dark and stormy mood right now.
I like the dark and stormy mood.
This is what happens when you touch octopus all day long.
Yeah, true enough, true enough. Well, I'm feeling uncomfortable, but we're going to get through this tonight. Actually, thanks for bringing the food.
You're very welcome.
It's beautiful food, and I wanted to ask you real quick, what was it about your childhood that really brought you to this place where you're sitting today?
Well, it's probably the number one question everybody asks every chef, and the answer is almost the same for every chef I know. It's those childhood memories of growing up and having a grandmother give you something really delicious, or an aunt. And I was fortunate because the women in my family actually could cook,
yeah,
from top to bottom, and the men as well. So, you know, I come from a Mediterranean background, and food is an important source of community relationships, whether you're at a chicken dinner at the Greek Orthodox Church, or if you're having Passover at a friend's house, or Seder, or just eating at grandma and grandpa's. So the recuerdos del niños, you know, the childhood, yeah, memories are still strong.
And I got to tell you, we're into our interviews here recently, and I've found that not every chef has a childhood memory of good food. Can you believe that?
Well, I didn't say it had to be good.
Yeah.
Maybe they were tortured with food and it,
well,
inspired,
you know,
them.
It's what's interesting about talking with a chef is how different they actually are. And I have some great childhood memories, but you brought up something interesting, the chicken dinner at the Greek Orthodox Church.
Oh yeah. I grew up with a lot of Greek boys, and one way to earn a little extra cash was to go work the dinners that they would do for weddings and special events. And without fail, it was roast chicken with oregano and lemon.
Yeah.
And little orzo with some olive oil and garlic, and then maybe some avgolimina soup. So I had good food coming at me from every ethnic angle, from crackers to Arabs to Greeks to Jewish families. They all took very good care of me.
Define crackers. No, I'm just kidding. Don't do that. The you know, the reason I say that about the Greek Orthodox, because you know, when I lived in Washington, D.C., the Greek Orthodox churches used to have the greatest food festivals.
Absolutely.
And they were unbelievable. And that was a memory I have from my adulthood, because we did not have Greek Orthodox churches where I grew up in Pennsylvania.
My mother got mad at me one time because I asked her if we could go have Thanksgiving over at the Metaxas's, because those women did such an amazing job that even as a child, you would have to get up from the table kind of ceremoniously, unbutton your pants so that you could have room for the next barrage of the Greek degustation, as it were, and never mind the desserts that came, because there would be, yeah, 10 or 11 different kind of desserts with a lot of loud yelling and discussion afterwards.
Yeah. So who in your family, what do you think was like the biggest influence on your life? It doesn't have to be really food, because, you know, you're a chef, so your whole life has to do with what you're doing on a daily basis.
Well, there are a couple of people. You know, my mom, obviously, because she raised five kids by herself with some help from the kids themselves and her family. But she did so at a time that was really difficult in the country. It was during the Vietnam War. She was an Army nurse. She had a lot of responsibility, not just with the kids, but in her own job, just sort of witnessing that whole spectacle or debacle. And, you know, it affects you, it impacts you, and it makes you really respect, especially now that I'm old and gray, how hard she had to work to keep a family together and a household and a career. I can't even remember her really taking a vacation on her own or having a Liz Taylor kind of splurge on herself.
Yeah.
It all went to the family and the kids and sort of pushing us forward and supporting us. And then, truthfully, you know, I've had so many great mentors, you know, at each stage of my life. I always like to say I'm on my fourth lifetime.
Yeah.
You need mentors, you know, because they gently prod you. And in my case, they did it without yelling. You know, I gladly gobbled up whatever knowledge or inspiration they gave me and always asked for more. Maybe that's being the youngest kid in five. You know, you sort of hunger for that attention that you never really got.
Yeah.
But, you know, it starts at home and then moves on to your teachers, your pedagogues. And then, you know, out there in the world, inspirationally, there's so many great people. Greg Hartman, for example.
Well, thank you. I appreciate
the innovator of the chocolate chip cookie raid late at night at the Clifton Inn.
Yeah, man.
You know, I've had some chefs that I really just thought the world of. Bill Sajak in Portland. Rafael Costa, whom I didn't work with very long in Providence, but, you know, a guy with one arm running a restaurant like that was pretty inspiring, and the food was phenomenal, you know, just phenomenal. Yeah. And then, you know, people that make it happen every day, you know, farmers that are out there scraping out a living. I had a delivery today from Gail Hobbs. And
Sure.
Every time I see her, I want to give her a shoulder rub and I rub her feet. I never do it. But I really appreciate what they do because it keeps me going to see other people that are likewise inspired.
True. Well, listen, the...
Are you looking for short answers?
No. You can talk all night, Tomas. This is all... It's all good because what we're trying to do is really kind of get inside, figure out. Because now you've been called a madman. Have you ever heard that before?
Oh, yeah. Recently.
What does that mean?
I think people have said that I make pompously delicious food. I think, you know, I really like to focus and concentrate on the flavors that I'm trying to bring out from products that I try not to over enhance or process. Mm-hmm. And so you really have to have your sort of total logic and your senses in that direction and not accept compromise on that. It doesn't mean you have to be a jerk, but you really have to say, like, that's not good enough. We start again. And that's the way I was taught in really every aspect of my life, sports, mm-hmm. school, the arts. You know, if you know a right way to do something, there is no other way to do it. You only do it that way. You don't go the easy way out. So I've had people that work for me tell me that I'm tenacious in that way. And I think it's the little things that add up to a big picture and create a nuance of experience that's really very layered and sort of last a long time for people. And it requires constant supervision, constant obsession, if you will, with the quality and the character of the people you're working with and the materials. So I try and treat it like you would if you were a sculptor working with a piece of marble. right. trying to bring out that imagery that is in that marble, that spirit. But I don't want to pat myself on the back too much.
No, no, it's not that. It's like, look here, you went to school for architecture, right?
Yeah, I went to architecture school.
And you also danced. Is this true?
Yeah, I did that long before my architecture, about 200 yeah. pounds ago.
Yeah.
As a kid, and I was really lucky. I was sort of petering out on sports, and people moved into my hometown of Savannah that were from American Ballet Theater, New York City Ballet, and they yeah. started rejuvenating that program there for young people, and I got in on the first wave.
Yeah.
And fortunately for me, it was the last wave of big doofus guys that they accepted into School of American Ballet at Juilliard.
Yeah.
After me, they only took kids that had been doing it for 10 years. But that was probably one of the greatest moments of my life, was getting involved in that.
Yeah, but let's go back to the Juilliard thing. You say big doofus guys in Juilliard. You might be just stretching that a little. You don't,
not really,
you don't get into Juilliard for being a big doofus guy. You get in there for passion, I think. And
definitely.
Because I think when they look at people, they don't always look at like one dimension. It's every dimension, right?
Well, it's amazing. It's actually not part of Juilliard. It was at that time in the Juilliard building in Lincoln right. Center. Now they've split off, and it's New York City Ballet School.
Sure.
They have it all by themselves mm-hmm. on the west side. But they look in every nook and cranny. They come and they check you out like a thoroughbred. They have these Russians and Germans and French and Danes, and they manipulate you, and they look at pictures of your family. And so, my whole family, we were very athletic growing
yeah.
up, and, that was a great outlet for us, especially if you didn't have a lot of money. Sports was an area you could exceed in. And, one time, all five of us were state champions in a couple sports.
Yeah.
So, when I say big doofus, I mean sort of the prototypical American athletic kid
sure.
who does tennis, football, baseball. That's not what they're looking for. But I could pick a girl up and carry her around and not drop her on her head. And that was worth
its
weight in gold.
That is amazing.
So, I have to tell you, when you, this from cooking, there are just these moments of beautiful clarity and lucidity where you've done something really good and you know it. And
yeah.
we had so many of those moments when we danced. I can't count them. They were so great. They
yeah.
give you goosebumps to think about them, and very proud of it. But it was just part of that path that led me into cooking.
Well, and so we're talking about sports too, because I always felt like, these team things
yeah.
made for a better leader in the kitchen. How do you equate the sports?
I try not to use too many sports metaphors because I don't have many athletes on my staff, and it's sort of lost on them. But
so you give it to them, they're like, excuse me?
Yeah, I'm like, quit dropping the ball. And they're like, what ball? What are you talking about? But I think about it as a team and being a coach, and putting people in the right places at the right time. But from their side, I can also use the metaphor of musicians or orchestra musicians. That is, you're serving the cause of the music, not of yourself. So
yeah.
that's why the way we have our restaurant set up, people work as a team concept. We pool our tips. We don't have she's over here and I'm over
sure.
here and she's an island and she does her thing and we do our thing. It's total awareness of your environment there. So the arts helped me with that because it created a discipline very similar to sports, even more
mm-hmm.
so. Because in sports, you're not really thinking, well, I need to perfect myself. You're
yeah,
thinking,
right.
I want to jump higher. I want to go faster. And it's very individualistic at times. But in the arts, you're told to serve something that's bigger and greater than you.
Yeah.
The music or the choreography or the vision of a particular production. And when you're in the kitchen, it's very theatrical, as you know.
Sure.
We don't wear as much makeup.
Thank God. Thank God for that.
I have not seen anybody in tights in a long time. But I suspect some of my cooks have them on under their clothes. I think that's the most apt metaphor is when I'm cooking or administering, whether it's a wine tasting or dinner, you know, I'm always thinking ahead. My head's on a swivel like a football player would be, trying to make sure and anticipate what's going to go on. And we try and foster that in all the employees,
yeah,
so that they have that overall awareness that makes them both very comfortable and confident. But it takes a lot of stress off their shoulders so they can enjoy themselves and articulate what we're doing to customers who may need their help.
Yeah. Some,
as we were saying before the show started, people's food IQs are like off the charts now. So sure, my staff often is not as well-traveled and sometimes not as knowledgeable as, say, Taylor Smack from the middle of Washington who comes in,
yeah,
some wine every now and then.
Right.
So we have to really keep pushing ourselves to learn more and attain and achieve more content and knowledge, in the same way that a dancer tries to do more turns and reach that sort of perfection, which everybody knows you can't reach.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But you have to keep trying.
Yeah. Well, if you look, we know that Maas is like the whole package. You know, it's the, you know, from when you're walking up, the way it smells, the way it sounds, the way it's decorated, the food, the people that are there. So it's like a show. But have you think that way when you first opened? I know that you worked many restaurants here in Charlottesville, Portland, also Rhode Island.
Yeah, Providence.
Did you? When was the first time you had this moment where you could say, okay, this is it. I create this show, period.
Well, you know, that space has a really interesting history. And when I was a student, I used to go by there, and friends, the more bohemian friends that lived on that side of town,
yeah,
I would always look at it longingly and say, my God, why isn't that being used? Because it was a cascade of bad ideas, mm-hmm, commercially in there. And so it was sort of unfulfilled potential in the middle of this quaint, if not frozen in time, kind of neighborhood. So my original vision, and I actually confirmed this, I went back and looked at diaries, yeah, from like 1991.
Wow.
When I was still here in school, and there it was, like Tapas Bar in Belmont, and then a couple thoughts after a trip to Madrid and Barcelona, uh-huh, like stone, iron, brick, you know, very sort of elemental conditions. So that started to come together. And, you know, all that was in jeopardy when we worked with a team of student designers and a couple of our architects, because, right, they didn't share the same vision. So, as you know, whether it's the head of a corporation or,
sure,
a design team, you've got to fight for your vision,
yeah,
and keep a good grip on it. And I was really fortunate when we first started, I had a woman, who sadly is no longer with us, Marion Kingdon, who shared my vision and helped me bring that about. And I'll always remember, we weren't even ready to be open. You know,
yeah,
as you know, in Charlottesville, contractors are a metaphor themselves.
Right.
Deadlines are a very sort of whimsical suggestion.
Sure.
And so we were 6 months behind. We still didn't have a reliable source of gas or electricity. We were using all kinds of tricks.
Mm-hmm.
And she pulled off a dinner just for the media. And it really inspired me. She found these old silver candelabras and the silver plate flatware. And
yeah,
I, you know, all we had was that bar, that 35-foot concrete bar. We didn't have anything else.
Yeah.
And I somehow produced a bunch of food, paellas, some anchovies. I had a half a sheep, which I had to fabricate over at Reed's Market, and they asked me what kind of pig it was, and I said, it's a sheep pig, and I'm cutting the chine bones on their saw, and I mean, the ribs were like this long when we put them out. We went for this sort of Peter Greenaway moment,
yeah,
that sort of set the germ in my head in 2002 that, yes, this was the way to go. And I'd always had the idea that we were going to do, like the food, very minimalist and very simple presentation, low lighting, so that the food was the focus at all times.
Yeah.
And the people secondarily. And because we're in the middle of this neighborhood, you know, we wanted to make it inviting for people to come in there. Now, as you've been in there, it's described most frequently as post-industrial Gaudi, and there's not a lot of people in central Belmont that have that in their vernacular.
Yeah.
But surprisingly, we have an incredibly erudite neighborhood, incredibly diverse people, and it's not just people that work in body shops.
Yeah, right.
Or people that run livestock down at the Hogwaller. I mean, Jimmy Denner was one of our first customers, and he loved it. He'd often cruise by on his riding lawnmower, which is like the Ferrari of Belmont, and wave and send people over. So trying to recapture that European feel was important to me. Trying to integrate that with the feel of the neighborhood was very important. And then having to deal with a team of designers that had their own ideas completely, mainly about materiality. They
sure.
didn't really understand spatially how restaurants work.
Yeah.
And the need for them to be functional and the need for things to be where they need to be.
Yeah, right.
And how that sort of delicate, if not frantic choreography at night when people are running around without ever hitting each other has to be followed in an almost shaker type way, you know, where you know predictably where somebody's going to be, especially if you got a big guy like me on the line that could take out three of them in the mosh pit without any problem.
Yeah, true.
If they make one wrong step. So the vision, I think, with Marion's help and the input of all those other people was adapted freely, let's just say, from our original plan and my sketches and my, you know, I did a lot of photographs when I was in Europe,
mm-hmm.
Not to copy things, but really things that were emotive. Like you walking into an old 700-year-old bar in Madrid,
right.
you know, and just going, holy, you know what? And it helped that I'm from a very old place, Savannah, where
right.
the buildings are extremely old. The little island I grew up on, 10 miles southeast of it, is full of Annabella mansions. I grew up playing on a Spanish tabby fort on an old plantation. So I had a lot of respect for that history and tradition already. And I also had respect for those forms. So when you go to Barcelona or Madrid or San Sebastian, you're blown away by the civic buildings. You're blown away by the public architecture,
mm-hmm.
but also the little gestures that people make towards their everyday life. The beauty of the craft of an archway going into a restaurant sometimes just sets you up. So I wanted to have that gotcha moment when people walked in the mosque, those
right.
big glass doors, and just went, what the hell?
Yeah.
Here I am in this neighborhood, in this nondescript brick building without a sign on it. I'm not even sure I'm in the right place. And so that, we try to capitalize on that moment where they don't know what to expect, and we're able to hopefully exceed their expectations.
Well, let me ask you, how many chefs in this town do you think have that kind of vision?
Gosh, you know, I used to feel that way about Brian Emperor, who started 10.
Yeah.
But after a while, he made it clear to me he didn't really care about those things.
Yeah.
He just was about the food only.
Right.
And
I'm not setting you up to talk shit about Charlottesville because it's a beautiful town and you love it. You wouldn't
I
be
love
here.
It.
But what I'm trying to, the point I'm making is, you know, you take your life and, you know, the dancing, the architecture definitely probably turned you into a pretty detail oriented person, I would think. I don't think you could be an architect without being like 1000% detailed, right? Is that the-
Well, not exactly. You know, I think it more than, first of all, I never actually became an architect.
Well, yeah, but you were in school.
I was in school, and my brother was already here in grad school. He
mm-hmm.
was an excellent architect.
Yeah.
I was a really lousy architect. it does give you an incredible appreciation for detail in what they call, you know, plans and programs.
Right.
And you know that things have to follow in a certain order. But
yeah, that's the word, order. That's what I was looking
it,
for.
At the same time, is very beautiful and lyrical and unpredictable. And you have to be comfortable with that fluidity, which, as you know from a kitchen, is the name of the game.
Yeah.
Because things never go the way they're supposed to, even though you have the program and the order
sure.
planned and set out, and your experience tells you it's going to be a certain way. But yeah, I bring my own life experiences to everything, and I really, in a very kind of obsessive way, try to integrate them all. And some people would call it holistically, and that includes how I relate to the neighborhood,
right?
How I treat my employees, how I treat my customers. My vendors are very important to us. So, you know, I don't know how many other people, I mean, you got to admit Angelo at the IVN
yeah.
has been great at what he's done
sure.
and kept that place where it is for a long time. I could say this very same for you, even more so. You're on your third or fourth lifetime now, and everything you've done has been spectacular.
Might be more lifetimes than that, but...
Well, I mean, we're both old cats. I like to think that a lot of people, Hayden Berry and Kathy,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Are guided by a lot of passion. But I was given a unique opportunity because I was given a building.
Right.
I was given a tabula rasa in Belmont that nobody had really reached out to or seen the potential for this kind of project before. And then I've been continuing on that path of adaptation and refining the very mm-hmm. simple theme and variations that we do. You know, we just use very simple ingredients.
Right. But they're beautiful ingredients. Do you sometimes look at these ingredients like treasures?
Totally. Totally. And one of my tools that I look at that way is that brick oven. So,
yeah.
But yeah, you put your hands in freshly milled organic flour and it moves you.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a sexual way, but it is beautiful. It's like gold dust.
Right.
And you realize, like, this was a field mm-hmm. of sunshine that was captured by this plant and converted into this by this miller and then sent to me, and I'm going to put it in a fire and transform it one more time and give it to people who are going to transform it one more time. So it is a really beautiful synchronicity of events. For so many things, but today, for example, we received some flounder, which for me, growing yeah. up on the water,
yeah.
is a rite of spring. And very soon, hopefully, we'll start getting some wild mushrooms,
mm-hmm.
another rite of spring. And Gail, we were talking baby goats today. So,
yeah.
you know, it all starts to come into play, ingredient and material wise. So, there's not one moment during the day where I'm not touching or smelling or tasting these things. And you realize when you go on vacation or you're in New York on a trip and you can't do those things, that you find yourself at a restaurant like reaching across the line
yeah.
or talking to the cooks.
Mm-hmm.
I was at a Mario Batali's Bar Jamon in
yeah.
Casimono, and I literally said to the guy, hey, watch it, the shrimp are burning. And he shot back at me like, what the fuck did you just say to me?
You know, I think I've done the same thing.
Like,
actually. I've done the same thing. Oh man, that's funny. Well, look, now that we look, I think we have a good feel for you, but what would you want your guests to think? I mean, you have all of this passion and you've thought this thing through, and it's a orchestrated kind of mad genius type of a place. But when the people come in, I know there's a lot of people who come and they just order, you know, I want this, they order it, okay, you know, it's a pork to puss or whatever, right. I got the pork to puss, I eat it. But what do you want them to know about you and your staff and everything they put into what
you... Well, you know, the main gesture I put through to the staff is we've invited a bunch of people over for dinner in our house tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very casual and informal, but these are our dear friends, and we don't want to disappoint them. Now, they may go home and say something mean about us when they get home, but let's avoid that, and let's just dazzle them with our generosity. And we begin every meal there with the gift of a plate of olives,
Right.
As sort of a initial act that we hope will be reciprocated throughout the evening as people share food amongst themselves. So when people come there, we really want them to be disarmed. We want them to be themselves, or what I call Charlottesville casual.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people in tuxedos will come in and get a PBR and a ham sandwich. Sometimes a guy who's been working in his carpenter shop all day in his bibs, or we have a farrier that comes in and he's all sooted up and got charcoal
nice.
All over him. They'll order the most expensive bottle of wine I've got and, you know, get the porctopus and some jamon serrano for the Iberico and just have the time of their lives. So we want them to come into our house. We want them to be comfortable. We want them to feel that they are taking part. And this was a very big part of how we planned this, sort of in an open source or a bespoke moment where they have part of the planning of the evening. So that's why our menu is just sort of an open list. We don't designate any particular order that you order. So a lot of people will order dessert first.
Yeah.
It's odd, but they do it. We don't dictate how you order your drinks or your wines. You can start with a cocktail, or you can start with a glass of sherry, or you can start with a glass of brandy. It's up to you.
Mm-hmm.
So we want them first and foremost to feel comfortable and then to develop a sense of trust with the staff. And then you can get to those moments where they come in, which happens frequently with our regulars, and they go, they just hand them the menu back and say, just order for me. And we just go through an informal degustación. And that's the greatest compliment. Although in the middle of a rush, it's a little frantic. But to say,
yeah, sure,
I trust you. Just send me whatever you want to send, whenever you've got. And I love it as a chef because it can be 20 different things. And, you know, we'll write it. We'll handwrite it down right in front of our station or on a napkin. This guy got a piquillo pepper with lobster. She has this.
Mm-hmm.
And we do it that way. So hopefully we succeed with that initial gesture of welcoming them. And because of the volume of people we can do sometimes, that may be lost on new people who are a little disoriented because they're used to sitting at a table and everybody gets
ordering an appetizer.
I love older couples. They're like, well, I've got my food. Where's my husband's food? You know,
right.
You're like, honey, you're supposed to share. Put your forks down. Use your fingers. And so it's a bit of a food seduction, and the gestalt is touching and smelling and tasting. But we really feel like putting people that close to the food not only disarms them, but it actually makes them appreciate the food more. You know, a lot of people come in and they just eat it, or they dump salt and pepper on it and they don't taste it, or they don't see it for what it is. And I don't want them to do that. And if it means taking them out of their comfort zone, so be it. The communal eating for us is really important because sharing immediately sets up a series of relationships at a table.
Yeah, right.
So that we even allow two different parties to share the same table.
Nice.
Which, if you've never seen it happen before, it's a beautiful thing. You know, that we'll be like, sorry, we only have an 8-top left and you are 2 4-tops. Do you mind sharing? They're like, no. You'll see 2 set of strangers start sharing food throughout the evening, and it's magic.
Yeah.
It's magic.
Yeah, I'm seduced. I'm seduced already. I feel like giving you a hug. Well, look, one more thing before we go. So, you know, this is your life, obviously. Do you have a personal life?
You know, from time to time, you know, it's the last 3 years, I would say absolutely not.
Yeah.
And the first 5 years we were open, I'd say absolutely not. But Charlottesville being what it is, you're constantly being drawn out. People here are so generous, and they love to have a good time. So when you get an invitation to go to a casual into the summer cocktail party and you show up and it's a state house with like 800 people and 4 or 5 bands, you know, you don't want to miss those moments because they're Charlottesville gold.
Yeah.
But I try to, I saw a friend today, he was having his birthday in the restaurant, which we get a lot of birthday celebrations. Yeah. and we love to fish together. He grew up in Jacksonville. I grew up in Savannah. And the first thing we talk about is when we're going out to catch blue tuna, mm-hmm. which is our that's our Moby Dick.
Yeah.
You know, they just, like, for example, caught an 800-pound blue off of North Carolina, you know? And so I don't get as much of that downtime. When I do get it, I like to go to Spain.
Yeah.
And spend time there with the producers and the artists that give us so many beautiful things, like this organic wine I brought you. And not just show my appreciation, but let them show me the genie in the bottle that they've created where they
are. Sure.
And, you know, that gets me even more grounded and jacked up when I come back to town. Hold on.
So you obviously live what you do. And I tell people that before. I have people say, wow, you work a lot of hours. And I say, well, guess what? I make my own schedule.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to sit here and complain to you. Yeah. This is what I love. And obviously you love it. If there was anything that you would, when you're gone, Tomas, you like that? I thought this is the first time I've ever asked this question. When you're gone, how do you want people to look back and say, Tomas Rahal, who was that guy?
Yeah, I've thought about lots of epitaphs, and none of them come to mind right now. But probably,
do it well. We're going to put it to music later on. You know, da-da-da.
Oh, I've got my own theme song. It's the Gladiators' entrance in Ben-Hur.
You got that? The Gladiators.
The Charlton Heston Ben-Hur. But I would like them to say he made a difference.
Yeah.
Because that was a promise that I made to myself and my mom, who passed away in 99, you know, just to be a better person, make a difference in the world. Can't change everything, but you can make a big difference where you are. And Charlottesville is filled with really wonderful people who make a difference in other people's lives.
True.
In unbelievable ways. I'm one big guy, but one teeny little speck in that universe. So that would be nice. For people to think of me kindly like that.
Cool.
Otherwise, fuck them.
That's what I'm talking about. Well, folks, you've heard it here at Chew the Fat. And obviously, what we heard tonight was from a person who loves or is having a love affair with his life and what he does. And I think it's really cool, Tomas. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you.
And,
great beer.
Well, thanks. And folks, you can find us at chewfat.net. That's chewfat.net. And please sound out, you know. Let us know what's cool. Let us know what's not cool. Give us any feedback that you want to give us, any questions that I didn't ask people that you'd like me to ask. Please do it. But remember to tell all your friends. Because, you know, when you go out to eat dinner, it's really cool to know the heart behind the food. So, thanks again for listening. It's Craig Hartman out.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the